Hello and welcome to another edition of Maplewood Barn Radio Theater, brought to you in conjunction with KBIA. In our continuing efforts to bring you nothing but the best classic stories, tonight's offering is an audio dramatization of an award-winning story, Golden Dreams, based on the writings of Stephen Lecoq. Mr. Lecoq is a bit vague about what award it might have won, so perhaps we can learn more from our protagonist, the professor. Let's turn it over to him so he can tell you all about the book, Golden Dreams.
The bell on the door jingled as I entered the bookstore.
Do you wish to look about the store? Oh, it's you, sir. You'll find some things that might interest you in the back of the store on the left. And we have here a series of reprints. Universal knowledge from Aristotle to Arthur Balfour at 17 cents. Or perhaps you might like to look over the pantheon of dead authors at 10 cents. Mr. Sparrow, please show this gentleman our classic reprints, the 10 cent series.
With that, he waved his hand to an assistant and dismissed me. Yes, he had me figured out in a moment. I was a professor, and he knew it. Which meant, number one, I did not have much money to spend, and, number two, that I would hang around for 2 hours, get in everybody's way, and finally buy a cheap reprint of the dialogues of Plato, or the prose works of John Milton, or Locke on the Human Understanding, or some trash of that sort. As for real taste in literature, the ability to appreciate a $1.50 novel from last month in a spring jacket with a tango frontispiece, I didn't have it. He despised me, of course, but a professor standing in a corner buried in a book looks good in a bookstore. The real customers like it. So Mr. Sellier, the manager, tolerated my presence in a back corner of his store, and this allowed me to watch his methods with his real customers, methods so successful, I might say, that he is rightly looked upon by everyone in the publishing business as one of the mainstays of literature in America. I had no intention of listening in like a spy. In fact, to tell the truth, I had become immediately interested in a new translation of the moral discourses of Epictetus. I had hardly read more than the first three chapters when my attention was diverted by a conversation going on at the front of the store.
You're quite sure it's his latest?
Oh, yes, Mr. Rasselyer. I assure you this is his very latest. In fact, it only came in yesterday.
As he spoke, he indicated a huge pile of books, gaily jacketed in white and blue. I could make out the title in big gilt lettering, Golden Dreams.
Oh, yes, this is Mr. Slush's latest book. It's selling wonderfully.
All right, then. You see, sometimes you can get taken in. I came here last week and took two that seemed very nice. And I never noticed until I got home that they were both old books, published, I think, 6 months ago.
Oh, dear me, Mr. Rasselyer. I'm extremely sorry. Please, send them back to me and let me exchange them for you.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Of course, I didn't read them. I gave them to my butler. He probably won't know the difference anyway.
I suppose not. But of course, sir, such mistakes are bound to happen sometimes. We had a very painful case only yesterday. One of our oldest customers came in a great hurry to buy books to take on a cruise. And before we realized what he had done, selecting the books, I suppose, merely by the titles, as some gentlemen are apt to do, he had taken two of last year's books. We called the shipyard at once, but I'm afraid it was too late.
But now, this book, is it good? What's it about?
It's an extremely powerful thing. In fact, masterly. The critics are saying that it's perhaps the most powerful book of the season. It has a...
And here Mr. Sellier paused, reminding me of a similar situation where I was explaining something in a university classroom that I didn't understand myself.
It has a power, so to speak, a very exceptional power. In fact, one may say without exaggeration is the most powerful book of the month. Indeed. It's selling wonderfully. Copies are flying out the door.
You seem to have plenty of them left.
Oh, we had to overstock. There's been such a rush on this book. Indeed, it's made quite a sensation in certain circles. They are saying that it should be banned.
Oh, really? Well, I'll take it then. Mature readers should take time to educate themselves about what is inappropriate. And, oh yes, I almost forgot. Will you send something to the house for Mrs. Rasselyer at the same time? She's going down to Virginia for vacation. You know the kind of thing she likes, don't you?
Oh, yes, precisely, sir. Mrs. Rasselyer generally reads work of, I think she buys Maltese books on,
travel and that sort of thing.
Exactly. I think we have something here that Mrs. Rasselyer will really enjoy.
He indicated a row of handsome books. 7 weeks in the Sahara, $7. 6 months in a wagon, $6.50. Afternoons in an ox cart, 2 volumes, $4.50 with 20% off.
I think she has read those. At least there are an abundance of at home that look like those.
Oh, yes, that is possible. Let's see. Among the Cannibals of Corfu. Yes, I think she has that one. Yes, that one too, I think. But this I am certain she would like. Just in this morning. Among the Monkeys of New Guinea. And only $10.
With this, Mr. Sellier put his hand on a pile of new books that were stacked just as high as Golden Dreams.
Among the Monkeys.
It seems rather expensive.
Oh, yes, it is a most expensive book. You see, Mr. Rasselyer, it's the illustrations, actual photographs of actual monkeys taken with an actual camera. And the glossy paper, in fact, the book costs $9.90 to manufacture. Of course, we have no profit on it, but it's a book we like to handle for the edification of the public.
And here I learn two of the great maxims of Mr. Sellier's sales methods. Everybody likes to know how much it costs to make something, and everybody likes to know that a bookseller is losing money. So naturally, Mr. Rasselyer bought Among the Monkeys, and in another moment, Mr. Sellier was bowing deeply as he showed the gentleman out the door. As he turned back to the counter, he murmured to his assistant,
"That monkey book is going to be a pretty tough sell."
But he had no time for further speculation. A woman entered. She was dressed in black and was obviously in mourning. Mr. Sellier changed tactics in the blink of an eye.
"Oh, Mrs. Gower, I was so sorry to hear about your terrible loss."
"Yes, it was quite a shock."
"Ah, yes, but your husband was a good man and will always be remembered for his..."
"My husband? My husband's fine. It was my dog that passed away, my precious, beloved little schnauzer."
"Oh, yes, of course. Sorry for the... How may I help you today, Mrs. Gower?"
"I need something to chase these blues away. Something new in fiction, perhaps."
"Something new in fiction. Why, yes, madam. Here's a charming work. Golden Dreams. Melancholy, yet uplifting. A very sweet story. Singularly sweet, in fact, madam. The critics are saying is the sweetest thing that Mr. Slush has ever written."
"Is it good?"
I was beginning to realize that everyone asked this.
"A charming book. It's a love story, very simple and sweet, yet wonderfully charming. Indeed, the reviews say it is the most charming book of the month. My wife was reading it out loud only last night. She could hardly read for the tears."
"I suppose it's a safe book, if you know what I mean. I want it for my little daughter."
"Oh, quite safe. In fact, written in the old style, like the dear old books of the past, quite like Dickens and Fielding and Thackeray and so on. We sell a great many to the clergy, madam."
"All right, I'll take it. What's it called? Golden Dreams. Well, at least the title is intriguing."
After that, the customers came and went in a string. I noticed that though the store was filled with books, 10,000 of them maybe, Mr. Sellier was apparently selling only two, Golden Dreams and Monkeys of New Guinea. I felt that I had lingered long enough. I approached the counter with Epictetus in my hand.
"Yes, sir, Epictetus. A charming thriller, 18 cents. Yes, Professor, thank you. Perhaps we have some other things that might be of interest to you. We have a few secondhand things in the alcove there that you might care to look at. There's an Aristotle, 2 volumes. Very fine thing, practically illegible. that you might like. And a Cicero came in yesterday, very choice, damaged by water. And I think we have a Machiavelli, quite exceptional, practically torn to pieces, with the covers gone. A very rare old thing, sir, if you're interested.
No, thank you. But that book, Golden Dreams, you seem to think it's an excellent work?
Just between you and me, it's a bad business. The publishers have unloaded the thing on us, and we have to do what we can. They're stuck with it, I understand, and they look for us to help out. They're advertising it widely and may pull it off, but there's just a chance. You can't tell. It's just possible we may get the church people down on it, and if so, we'll be all right. But outside of that, we'll never make it. I imagine it's absolutely rotten.
Haven't you read it?
Oh, no, of course not. There is no way I could read all the new books, even if I wanted to. It's hard enough to keep track of them as it is, without cluttering up my brain with what's inside them.
But those people who bought the book, won't they be disappointed?
Oh, no. They won't be bothered a bit. You see, they won't read it. They never do.
But still, your wife thought it was a great story.
I am not married, sir.
As disconcerting as this was, I was consumed by curiosity about the book, Golden Dreams. There was just something about it I could not quite put my finger on, alluring, yet repellent. In the end, I could not resist, through means that cannot fully be related here, on the grounds that I might incriminate myself. I acquired a copy of the book and offer my observations about it here. Due to time constraints, I cannot dramatize the whole first chapter, but let's pick it up on one of the many decks of the Gloritania, one of the most luxurious cruise ships of its time. Seated on the deck is Vere de Lancey, a typical young Englishman of the upper class. He is the nephew of a duke, but no one of the ship is aware of this fact, except for the captain, the purser, the stewards, and the passengers. In order to conceal his identity, Vere de Lancey is traveling under the assumed name of Lancey de Vere, and he has told everyone that he is traveling merely as a gentleman anxious to see America. This naturally baffles all those in contact with him. There is a girl at his side, one that fascinates him. Why is she here? Why is she not somewhere else? The thing puzzled and perplexed him. At last he speaks.
And so you, too, are going to America?
Yes.
Ah, I suspected so ever since we left Liverpool.
Yes, it is 3,213 miles wide, is it not?
Yes, and 1,781 miles deep. It reaches from the 49th parallel to the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, what a vivid picture. I seem to see.
Its major axis is formed by the Rocky Mountains, which are practically a prolongation of the Coeur d'Alene Range. It is drained.
How splendid.
Yes, is it not? It is drained by the Mississippi, by the St. Lawrence, and, dare I say it, by the upper Colorado.
Oh, go on. These facts send tingles down my spine.
The great central plain of the interior is formed by a vast alluvial deposit carried down as silt by the Mississippi. East of this range of the Alleghenies, which forms as a subordinate axis from which the watershed falls to the Atlantic.
Oh my, no one has ever spoken to me like this before. What a wonderful picture you paint.
Through the whole of it, there run railways, most of them from east to west, though a few run west to east. The Pennsylvania system alone has 21,000 miles of track.
21,000 miles?
Dare I tell you how many people live there?
No, don't. I can't bear it. Some other time, perhaps, but not now. And you, why are you going to America?
Why? Because I want to see, to know, to learn. And when I have learned and seen and known, I want other people to see and to learn and to know. I want to write it all down, all the vast palpitating picture of it. Ah, if only I could. I want to see something of the relations of labor and capital, of the extraordinary development of industrial machinery, of the new and intricate organization of corporate finance, and in particular I want to try to analyze. No one has ever done it yet. The men who guide and drive it all. I want to set down the psychology of the multimillionaire.
Perhaps I could help you.
You?
Yes, I might. I come from America.
You? With a face and voice like yours? It's impossible.
Oh, don't be a flatterer. But I do come from America. My people live just outside of Hoboken.
They couldn't have.
I shouldn't speak to you like this, but you seem to love America, and I think I can help you.
You mean you can help me to meet a multimillionaire?
Yes.
You know one?
Yes, I know one. I must go. Good night.
But wait! Wait! I don't even know your name! Good night.
And she was gone. Time limits forbid my dramatization of the next several chapters. One chapter offers the most vivid description of the inside of an American customs house ever presented in words. The next tells how Devere was driven by taxi from the customs wharf to the Belmont Hotel. Here he engages a room. Here, too, he sleeps. Here also, though cautiously at first, he eats. All this is so admirably described that only those who have ridden in a taxi to a hotel and slept there can hope to appreciate it. Due to time constraints, we cannot give a full dramatization of Devere's vain quest in New York for the beautiful creature he had met on the steamer and whom he had lost from sight in the customs house. A thousand times he cursed his folly for not asking her name.
I curse my folly! I curse it!
And so on. Meanwhile, no word comes from her until suddenly, mysteriously, unexpectedly, on the fourth day, a note is handed to Devere, addressed in a lady's hand. He tears it open and reads.
Call on Mr. J. Superman Overgold. He is a multimillionaire. He expects you.
Now, the next portion of the novel is perhaps the most notable of all. It is the part in which the Hibbertown Journal calls the best piece of psychological analysis that appears of any novel in the season. I offer my dramatization of it here. Devere is writing rapidly in his notebook as he sits in one of the deep leather armchairs of the luxurious office of Mr. Overgold. He says,
Exactly, exactly. So you sometimes feel as though the whole thing is not worthwhile.
I do. I can't help asking myself what it all means. Is life, after all, merely a series of immaterial phenomena, self-developing and based solely on sensation and reaction? Or is it something more? Is sensation all there is? Or is there perception too? On what grounds, if any, may the hypothesis of a self-explanatory consciousness be rejected? How far are we merited in supposing that innate ideas are inconsistent with pure materialism?
I think I grasp your thought. You mean, to what extent are we prepared to endorse Hegel's dictum of immaterial evolution?
Exactly. How far, if at all, do we substantiate the Kantian hypothesis of the transcendental?
Precisely. And why should we reject Spencer's theory of the unknowable?
Entirely so. And how, if at all, does Bergsonian Aleutianism differ from pure nothingness? It saddens one, does it not? Here, just look at this bundle of 2% gold bonds. The emptiness of it all. Here, do you want them, or shall I throw them out?
Here, I'll take them. It isn't worth the effort of throwing them out.
No, no, no. I would not think of foisting them on you. It is a burden that I must carry alone. I have no right to ask anyone to share it. But come, I fear I am sadly lacking in international hospitality. My car is at the door. Let me take you to my house for lunch.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
And in a moment they were speeding up the magnificent Riverside Drive toward Mr. Overgold's home. On the way, Mr. Overgold pointed out various objects of interest.
And over there is Grant's tomb. That's Lincoln's tomb. And there's Edgar Allan Poe's grave. And this little stream we are about to cross is where the Mayflower originally landed.
On arriving at the house, Devere was ushered up a flight of broad marble steps to a hall fitted on every side with objets d'art, ushered to the cloakroom and out of it, butlered into the lunchroom and footmaned into a chair. As they entered, a lady already seated at the table turned to meet them. One glance was enough. Plenty. It was she, the object of Devere's impassioned quest. She reached out her hand, smiling.
Hello.
Dorothea, this is Mr. Devere. Mr. Devere, my wife, Dorothea.
The next chapter gets a bit sticky since it deals with romance. The Red Light Tribune calls it the most daring and yet conscientious handling of the sex problem ever attempted. To be fair, the Congregational Times declared that this chapter will undermine the whole foundations of civilization as we know it and let it fall. But I will pass over that in order to give Golden Dreams its fullest treatments. Plus, I hold certificates in writing from a great number of the Presbyterian clergy, stating that they have carefully read the entire novel and seen nothing wrong with it. Devere and Dorothea stood staring at one another.
So, you didn't know?
You mean you knew that I didn't know, or that you didn't know that I knew?
Darling, you're slurping again. Please take your soup over to the window and eat it there.
Yes, dear.
You didn't know?
No, how could I?
And yet you loved me, even though you didn't know that I was married?
Yes, I loved you, in spite of it.
Splendid. Oh, darling, you're crunching your carrots. Please take them to the billiard room and eat them there.
Yes, dear.
Does he know, too?
Mr. Overgold? I suppose he does. How can we hide what we feel? I fear that you are very young, my friend. After all, what is wrong with it? To a man's mind, perhaps, but to a woman, love is love. Oh, Higgins, take Mr. Overgold a cutlet to the music room and give him his gorgonzola on the inkstand in the library. Thank you. And now, let's not think about it any more. Let's just accept what is.
I suppose so.
At any rate, nothing can exist and not exist at the same time. But come, let's not be gloomy any more. I want to take you with me to the matinee.
Is your husband coming?
Silly boy, of course John is coming. You surely don't want to buy the tickets yourself.
The days that followed brought a strange new life to Devere. Dorothea was always at his side, at the theater, at the polo ground, in the park, everywhere they were together. And with them was Mr. Overgold. The three were always together and formed one of the most perplexing, maddening triangles that ever disturbed the social circles of the city. All right, that covers the next six or seven chapters, but the denouement was bound to come, and it came. It was late at night. Devere is standing beside Dorothea in the brilliantly lighted hall of the Grand Palaver Hotel, where they had had supper. Mr. Overgold is busy for a moment at the cashier's desk.
Dorothea, I want to take you away, away from all this. I want you.
I will come.
Listen, the Gloritania sails for England tomorrow at midnight. I have everything ready. Will you come?
Yes, I will. I will follow you to England, to Liverpool, to the end of the earth. Come to the house just before midnight. Everything will be ready. My housemaid will not betray me. But there's just one thing, dearest, that I want to ask. It's not much. I hardly think you would refuse it at such an hour.
What is it, dearest?
May I bring my husband with me?
Is that really necessary?
I think so. You don't know how I've grown to value, to lean on him. I always wanted him to be near me. I like to feel, wherever I am, at a play, a restaurant, anywhere, that I can reach out and touch him. I know it's only a wild fancy, and that others would laugh at it, but you can understand, can't you? And I think, darling, in our new life, how busy he, too, will be, making money for all of us in a new money market. It's just wonderful how he does it.
Good idea. Bring him.
I knew you'd say that. And listen, little poquito pocket edition, may I ask one more thing, one teeny-weeny thing? William, the chauffeur. I think he would fade away if I were gone. May I bring him too? Yes? Oh, my darling, how can I repay you? And the footman? And the housemaid? If I were gone, I fear that none of them would be able
Bring them all. We will all elope together. And here comes the primary chaperone, your husband.
I wonder whether personality survives, or whether it, too, when up against the irresistible, dissolves and resolves itself into a series of negative reactions.
Devere's empty heart echoed the words. Then, at the darkened doorway, the knights swallowed them up. At a little before midnight the next night, two motors filled with muffled human beings might have been perceived, or seen, moving noiselessly from the riverside drive to the steamer wharf where lay the Gloritania.
It is a night of intense darkness here on the Hudson.
Yes. See how the dense fog wraps itself around the Statue of Liberty.
See how the steamer customs officers and deportation officials move silently to and fro in their long black cloaks, carrying little deportation lanterns in their hands.
Mr. Overgold presented his deportation certificates in silence.
These certificates grant my party permission to leave the United States under the imbecility clause of the Interstate Commerce Act.
You may proceed on to the boat.
A few moments later, the huge steamer was slipping away in the darkness. On its deck, a little group of people, standing beside a pile of first-class cabin luggage, gazed sadly at the rapidly vanishing shore which they could not see. Devere, who stood in the midst of them, clasping their hands, thus stood and gazed his last at America. He said in parting,
"Golden dreams!"
It seemed to me that this final panorama, weird in its midnight mystery and filling the mind of the reader with a sense of something like awe, is only appended to Golden Dreams in order to coax him to read the forthcoming sequel, Golden Slumbers, as advertised on the back flap. So this was the novel that Mr. Sellier was pushing. This was the book everyone was talking about. The novel that none of the fashionable ladies would read. It seems to me they might be missing out. The book was really quite hilarious, but not necessarily in the way it was intended.
And here's hoping that all of you have golden dreams, or at least golden slumbers, when you retire this evening. Our retelling of Golden Dreams is based on the writings of some unidentifiable Mr. Slush, as related by Stephen Leacock. We hope you've enjoyed this evening's Maplewood Barn Radio presentation. Our players were, as the Professor, Jeff Martin. We had Byron Scott as Sellier, Resselier, and Overgold. We're played by Michael Tooley. Gower and Dorothea by Molly Dodge. And Mr. Devere was portrayed by Terry Yates. This is your narrator and the program engineer, Darren Helwedge. We hope you'll join us again next week for another classic story right here on KBIA.